Hello, this is Debbie again. This is part two of the Wednesday, July 29th, 2015 Decatur Herald and Review, as read by Debbie off of the heraldreview.com website. There are only two obituaries today, and as we usually start the part two of this section of the paper. Decatur. Lucy May Biggs. Mother Lucy May Beals Biggs, 85, made her heavenly transition on Thursday, July 23rd in her home. Viewing will be held from 5 to 6 on Friday, July 31st at New Salem Baptist Church, followed by Eastern Star Rites at 6 p.m. There will be a period of reflection from 6:30 to 7 p.m. Homegoing service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, August 1st, at the Main Street Church of the Living God with Reverend Ronald Biggs officiating and Bishop Donald Biggs eulogist. Visitation 1 hour before service. Burial Greenwood Cemetery. Professional services entrusted to Walker Funeral Services. Next obituary, Marilyn A. Burris, Assumption. Marilyn A. Burris, 89, of Assumption, died July 26th in Heritage Manor, Pena. Graveside services will be 10 o'clock Saturday, August 1st in Pleasant View Cemetery, Assumption. Site's funeral home, Assumption, has been entrusted with the care and service arrangements. Condolences for the family may be left at their website. End of that obituary, end of the obituaries for Wednesday, July 29th. In sports news, we go to Illini basketball. There is a great picture of the coach looking very frustrated, obviously a picture from another game. It says, more bad luck struck Illinois coach John Gross and his Illini basketball program as Tracy Abrams will miss another season due to injury. This time it's an Achilles injury. This is by Mark Tupper, executive sports editor. Champaign, Illinois point guard Tracy Abrams will once again spend the season watching from the bench in street clothes after tearing his left Achilles tendon Monday. Abrams missed all of last season after suffering a torn ACL in his right knee in September during a workout. This will be Abrams' fifth season in the program and his future is uncertain. He could petition for a sixth season based on his medical hardship, but Coach John Grosch said Tuesday, it's too early to think about that. Tracy's hurting now, Grosch said. It's emotional. Obviously, I commend him for the effort he put forth to come back from the ACL. He did everything we asked and then some. It was the first player I've ever coached to have two back-to-back season-ending injuries. I'm sure it's happened before, but I can't think of one off the top of my head. It's a lot for him to digest. Grosch said the injury happened in a non-contact drill as the team began preparation for its tour of Belgium and France August 9th to 19th. That tour will include four exhibition games, but Abrams will not make the trip. Grosch said he is scheduled to have surgery on August 5th. Bummer. Two other players, freshman Jalen Coleman Lands and transfer Darius Paul, will travel with the team but will be withheld from practices and games as they deal with their own injuries. Coleman Lands, the highest-rated recruit in the current freshman class, was diagnosed with a stress fracture in his left leg. Paul is recovering from labrum surgery, L-A-B-R-U-M. Grosch said he hadn't had time to think about the point guard position without Abrams, but that part of the European trip will involve experimentation. We're going to exercise all options at this point, Grosch said. The great thing for us is we get nine more practices plus 2 hours a week we're allowed by the NCAA. We'll see if we can figure it out. Grosch had been excited about team and individual workouts until injuries derailed the process. Derailed the progress. Mike Thorne has been really good in practice, Grosch said, speaking about the 6'11", 270-pound center who's transferred in from Charlotte. He dropped double-digit pounds and is moving better. He has provided us with low-post scoring. He's an elite rebounder per minute played, and he can defend people at the basket. That's Mike Thorne. Freshman Aaron Jordan has gotten better. It's helped Kendrick Nunn to have a full summer after missing all of it last summer. Kendrick and Malcolm Hill are veterans and have been in a lot of situations the past 2 years. I expect a lot out of them in terms of leadership and everything they do. I have a very high bar for those two. Grosch said he's likely to reduce training camp to 4 weeks from normal 6-week session, pushing back the start till August 1st. We're optimistic that we can have both of them, Coleman, Lance, and Paul, back for the start of training camp, he said. End of the article. Next, headline says, Theft Victims Help Leads to Arrest. This is by Huey Freeman from the paper, Decatur. About 11:40 a.m. Saturday, a Northside resident saw a man enter her detached garage and walk off with her bicycle. When police arrived, she told patrol officer Christopher Eads that she knew the man as DeAndre, someone who had previously knocked on her door and offered to do odd jobs for her. She said she saw DeAndre pushing her red and yellow La Jolla brand bicycle south on Central Drive toward Garfield Avenue. Meanwhile, Officer Robert Hull stopped a man he saw walking across the Garfield Avenue overpass pushing a bicycle. He was identified as Andre Stewart, a 53-year-old parolee with an extensive criminal history, including several violent crimes. Stewart told Hull he'd borrowed the bicycle from a woman named Karen and had retrieved the bike from her garage. The name Stewart identified did not match the bicycle's owner's name, said an affidavit by a patrol officer. The bicycle owner was taken to the 700 block of East Garfield, where she identified her bicycle and Stewart as the man she saw removing it from her garage. Stewart was arrested and booked into the Macon County Jail on a felony charge of burglary. He is due in circuit court for his arraignment on Monday. Stewart, who has 8 prior felony convictions and has served 6 terms in the Illinois Department of Corrections, was most recently released from prison March 6 after serving 2.5 years of a 5-year sentence for aggravated battery in a public place. In that case, Stewart attacked a 32-year-old woman as she walked in North Woodford Street in the evening on August 30, 2012. He struck her with a metal broom handle, forced her into his garage, forced her to undress, robbed her, and threatened to pour gasoline on her and set her on fire. After fondling the victim, she managed to escape from the garage. She was originally charged with 6 felony counts, including aggravated kidnapping and aggravated criminal sexual abuse. He pleaded guilty to aggravated battery as part of a plea deal in which he received the 5-year sentence. End of that article. Next in the courts section, parolee arrested in connection with beating a woman. This is by Huey Freeman from the paper. Decatur, a 34-year-old parolee released from prison 4 months ago, is back in custody after he allegedly choked a woman, then punched her and kicked her about 15 times. Tyree Jenkins, who has served 6 prison terms, including 2 for domestic battery convictions against other female victims, is being held in the Macon County Jail without bond. On July 15th, Decatur police officers interviewed a woman who said she'd been attacked by Jenkins following an argument with him. She said the incident began inside a residence and ended in the front yard. Tyree grabbed her by the hair, pulled her to the floor, the victim said, according to an affidavit by Decatur Patrol Officer Ryan Anderson. Tyree held her by her hair and began to kick her and strike her with his free hand. She said he kicked her and struck her all over the body, mainly in her head and arms. He was wearing shoes at the time. She estimated he kicked her 15 times, struck her with his fist, her open hand, 6 times. When she tried to flee, he followed her outside. While in the front yard, Tyree reached and wrapped his hand around her neck and squeezed. The first time he grabbed her neck, she was unable to breathe for about 4 seconds. He grabbed her neck multiple times. The victim's visible injuries included bruises on her neck, below her jaw, red abrasion on her eyelid, bruises on her upper right arm, bruises on her inner left arm, multiple cuts to the back of her hand, and scrape on her ankle. She had cut her hand on broken glass and suffered other cuts and scrapes from crawling to get away from Tyree. The victim applied for an emergency order of protection July 20th, which was granted the following day. It was in effect until August 5th. In her petition for the order, the victim wrote that while Jenkins was beating her up, he threatened to kill her. He also said Jenkins choked her while she was pregnant in a prior incident. Jenkins was arraigned Tuesday on 2 felony counts, aggravated domestic battery and domestic battery with a prior domestic battery conviction. He's due in court August 12th for his preliminary hearing. Jenkins was released from prison March 19th after serving part of a 2-year prison term for 2012 conviction of domestic battery with a prior aggravated battery conviction. In that case, Jenkins grabbed a 32-year-old woman by the throat and pushed her into a garbage can, causing her to fall on the wet ground. End of the article. Next article. Governor Rauner halts payment of video gambling profits. Out of AP Arlington Heights. Illinois municipalities that host video gambling in bars and restaurants won't get their cut of profits from machines until the state budget's in place, Governor Bruce Rauner's office announced Monday. The Republican governor and Democrats in the state legislature have been at a budget impasse for weeks, and the state doesn't have the authority to distribute video gambling profits to municipalities across Illinois without a balanced budget, Rauner spokeswoman Catherine Kelly said in a statement. Some local governments reap thousands of dollars each month from the machines, while other towns have rejected video gambling. The Arlington Heights Daily Herald reported, last month, Hoffman Estates took in $23,289 from the machine, Elk Grove Village collected $16,475, and Hanover Park earned $8,472. Municipalities have already adapted their budget and used revenues assumptions that factor in the monthly video game payment, Lake County Municipal League Executive Director Mandy Florup said in a statement. This unpaid amount has the potential to create budget shortfalls to impacted communities in Lake County. A spokeswoman for Illinois Comptroller Leslie Munger said attorneys in her office are looking into the video gambling issue. Without a state budget in place, Illinois isn't able to pay many of its new bills. However, there are some exceptions. The statement from Rauner's office indicates his belief that video gambling payments won't be among those exceptions. The governor's camp places the blame for the state's inability to pass a balanced budget on House Speaker Michael Madigan and the legislators he controls. But Madigan believes Rauner caused the budget holdup, and he argued that the governor could have avoided a partial state shutdown by making changes to the budget that Democratic lawmakers sent to him in May and leaving the rest alone. The person who had the singular authority to avoid all of this was Governor Rauner, Madigan spokesman Steve Brown said. It's unclear how the delayed payments for video gambling will affect municipalities, but the financial hardships could vary widely. End of that article. An editorial from the paper says, council needs to move deliberately to replace McElroy. So this is an editorial from the Herald Review. It's a sad reality that even as the community continues to mourn the death of Mayor Mike McElroy, the Decatur City Council will soon have to fill his spot in City Hall. The decision's an important one. Decatur has gained a certain amount of momentum in the past few years, and optimism is on the rise. A lot of that is due to Project McElroy and the city were a part of, including the redeveloped downtown, the dredging of Lake Decatur, and the establishment of the Midwest Inland Port. At this point, the momentum and optimism is based primarily on potential. It is important that city leadership continue to work and collaborate across the community, continue building on the success it has created. The council can apparently choose any citizen in the city to be mayor under state law. The new mayor will serve until the next city election in 2017. However, as a practical matter, the mayor should come from the current council and should be one of the veteran council members. Julie Moore Wolf was elected by the council members as mayor pro tempore and is currently the acting mayor. Other veteran council members are former Macon County Sheriff Jerry Dawson, former executive director of the Macon County History Museum Pat McDaniel, and Dana Ray, a physician at Crossing Healthcare, formerly known as CHIC. The current council works well together, and the mayor's governing and administrative powers are limited to the city's form of government. Any of those experienced council members could do the job, and it may well come down to which one is in the best position to tackle the time-consuming ceremonial tasks involved with the job. Once a mayor is selected from the current council members, the council will then have to choose a new council member. We recommend that Bishop G.E. Livingston, who finished second to McElroy in April's mayoral race, be given strong consideration. Although Livingston's close alignment with union groups during the campaign was a concern, his message resonated with much of the community. He received 30% 36% of the vote, and finished about 1,200 votes behind McElroy. Livingston is CEO and president of Robertson Charter School and a pastor of Life Changers Church. Another viable candidate is David Horn, a professor at Millikan University. Horn finished a close fourth in the election for three open council seats. The council has some time to make the decision, but it'd be appropriate to move decisively. End of the editorial. Another sport article. A veteran at 18, co-missing a major. The criteria fits, and this is by the AP, the criteria fits for the label as the best player to have never won a major. Seven career victories, finishing no worse than third in just more than 30% of the tournaments. The number one player in the world for the first half of the season. Adding to the numbers is being viewed as one of the favorites at every major. What doesn't fit is the age. Lydia Ko just turned 18 a couple months ago. Is that too much to ask of someone so young? Not anymore. With the explosive youth movement in golf, age no longer is an excuse. No one was talking about Ko still being only 17 at the ANA Inspiration for the first major of the year. The number that week was 28 consecutive rounds under par, during which she won twice and rose to number one in the world. She opened with another subpar round. The streak ended the next day, and she tied for 51st. The first question she took from the floor at her next major was the glaring omission, a major from an otherwise acceptable record. Ko had never missed a cut in her career until the week at the KPMG Women's PGA Championship. A month later, she was never in contention at the U.S. Women's Open. Her next chance starts Thursday at Turnberry at the Ricoh Women's British Open. Ko no longer is number one in the world. NP Park replaced her by winning the Women's PGA Championship last week for her sixth major. Being the number two player only slightly eases the pressure on Ko, although the burden will get heavier with each passing major. And while it doesn't seem right that Ko should face such questions as a teenager, it doesn't seem that ludicrous when surveying the landscape. Lexi Thompson, who picked up her fifth career victory on Sunday, was 19 when she won her first major a year ago. Rory McIlroy and Jordan Spieth have shown in recent years that it's not just women's golf where youth is thriving. McIlroy was 22 when he set the U.S. Open scoring record at Congressional. He picked up his fourth major at age 25, joining Bobby Jones, Jack Nicklaus, and Tiger Woods to win that many at a men's major at such a young age. Spieth was 11 holes away from being the youngest Masters champion at 20 until Bubba Watson caught him in one hole and beat him on the back nine last year in Augusta National. Spieth made up for it this year with a green jacket at 21, second youngest winner behind Woods at Augusta, and a U.S. Open title that made him the youngest man with two majors since Gene Sarazen in 1922. Age is not the best measure these days. It's more about experience. Ko already had two LPGA Tour victories as an amateur, both at the Canadian Women's Open. She played a full schedule as an amateur, 12 events on the LPGA Tour in 2013, the last won her pro debut at the CME Group title holders. This is her third full season on the LPGA Tour, second as a pro. It speaks to her ability. An efficient swing, reliable putter, and remarkable calm, that she already is being asked about when she will finally win a major. Odds are it will happen before she's old enough to celebrate with a glass of champagne. Stacey Lewis was 26 when she won her first major, which might seem old by today's standards, except that Lewis is a throwback. She not only went to college, she finished college. Lewis turned pro at 2008 U.S. Women's Open. She won her first major in the third full year in the LPGA. That's about where Ko is now. She was talking about retiring when she's 30, though it's hard to tell if she's serious. Ko was asked Tuesday at Turnberry how many majors she would like to have by then. I have no idea, she said with a laugh. Even one would be amazing. End of the article. Love is all around this fuzzy ambassador for Evergreen Center, says the headline. This is by Emily Steele for the Herald and Review. Decatur. Gidget is used to being the center of attention, so besides the birthday cake, life was business as usual for Evergreen Seniors Living's dog of honor. Wearing her pink bandana and ear ribbons, Gidget posed for pictures, pounced on her new squeaky toy, begged for treats, and stopped by to visit with anyone who looked like they wanted to pet her. Last Friday, the residents and the staff celebrated the three-year-old Bichon Shih Tzu's birthday with a party, cake for all, and by taking donations for area pet shelters. The small dog, known as Gidge Monster or Princess, can be found perched on the front counter in her bright pink throne, otherwise known as the big door. can usually be found perched on the front counter in her pink throne, otherwise known as a dog bed. She just sits right on the counter and watches people come in, said owner Leslie West. Gidget got a gig several years ago when West worked there as the business manager. The director was a dog lover and encouraged West to bring a 9-week-old Gidget in for work, and it stuck. She became their facility mascot, visiting with residents, riding on scooters, and being spoiled by everyone. She knows when somebody needs more love, West said. She goes and takes naps with some of the residents, said her husband, David West. Joan Jenkins visits with Gidget every day to feed her tiny dog treats. When Jenkins moved to Evergreen a year and a half ago, she had to leave her own two dogs behind. Ever since I moved here, she filled a void. She made it bearable. But last year when West took another job, Gidget went with her. She was depressed because I couldn't take her to work anymore, Leslie West said. So they worked out an arrangement with David West. They worked out an arrangement where David West drops Gidget off for work several days a week and the front office staff keeps an eye on her. Lori Terrell and Andrea Robinson watch over Gidget and answer visitors' questions, especially when they mistake her for a stuffed toy. She's just as good for us as we are for her, Robson said. Staff, residents, and visitors donated $200 as well as several bags filled with treats, toys, and dog beds that go to Homeward Bound Pet Shelter and the Decatur and Macon County Animal Shelter Foundation. It's such a good cause in honor of the princess, Jenkins said. Gidget has even become so famous that when people come for a tour at Evergreen, they ask about her. That was one of the things that sold me when my family visited. She was the frosting on the cake, Jenkins said. End of the article. Different topic. Title is, or at least the headline, Houseworks, Edging's Worth the Trouble, Only Twice a Year. Twice a year, says Steve Batty for the Herald and Review, I edge my lawn. Unlike my father, I'm not among the lawn proud. If the grass is fairly green and not too shaggy and fits most of the space between the walks and the house, I'm good. I only do it twice a year because it's tedious, not difficult or even expensive, just unbelievably boring. My own system is a lot less troublesome than Granddad's. He'd go out regularly with his shovel and dig a tidy little trench along the front and back walks in the driveway that stretched from the street to the barn turned garage at the back of the lot. It amounted to about half a block on both sides. Occasionally, I still see such old-fashioned edges, people with much more time on their hands than money in their pockets, I'll wager. Dad didn't have an issue with money when it came to his yard. He of the turf so fine carpeting should be this lush lawn used a power edger. It was a mighty orange machine whose whirling blades sliced neat little furrows along the walks of his corner lot, which also amounted to about a half block on both sides. All Dad's machines were mighty. As a matter of fact, his mower and snowblower may very well have been stripped-down Volkswagens. The blower had 3 forward gears in reverse, the same as his old Ford pickup. I had the same issue with Dad's power edging that I had with Granddad's trenches. Once you do it, you can never stop. To leave him so narrow a strip of bare ground as Dad's furrows to track every crabgrass, spurge, and foxtail seed for miles around. I imagine Granddad must have fought off invading cedar trees and cottonwoods with his spaded trenches. That said, you may wonder why I edge at all. I'm puzzled over the question myself and decided it must be the engineer in me that also prompts me to arrange garden tools neatly on my garage wall and to regiment my raised planting beds in neat rectangles. It just looks better. So twice a year I edge my lawn, once in the summer after spring growth has abated and again in the fall so I'll be able to find the edges of the sidewalks when they're covered with snow. But I do not use a shovel and I do not use a power edger. I have Bigfoot. I bought the gadget about 30 years ago from a mail order outfit. I recall that it was manufactured in Oregon, but the label has identified the company as long since worn off. Bigfoot is nothing more than a footprint-sized plank, hank the name, attached by stirrup to a stout ash handle. A hefty piece of stainless steel projects down from the middle of the footprint rather than like a centerboard of a sailboard. To use Bigfoot, you position the blade via the handle at the juncture of the lawn and concrete and push it firmly in the ground with your foot. As you lift, move forward 12 inches and repeat, and repeat, and repeat. Tedious for sure, but that's all there is to it. It creates just a separation between grass and walk. No trench, no fur, and no furrow, no weeds. All it requires is its operator possesses enough girth to force the blade into the ground. This has not been a problem up to now. End of the article. Next article. This is not local, but it's kind of a charming story. 4 generations show animals at county fair. It's by Tammy Riel McKeegan from the Lee News Service. Fremont, Nebraska. When he showed his dairy calf at the Washington County Fair on Saturday, Garrison Mueller made family history. The five-year-old became the fourth generation of Muellers to show animals at the fair. What's more, he's part of a Nebraska farming heritage that began decades ago. Orlando Mueller, 86, of Hoover, said his great-grandfather started farming in Nebraska in 1867. That's the year Nebraska became a state. Orlando Mueller was about 14 years old when he started showing purebred hogs at the Washington County Fair. He later served in the U.S. Army for 2 years. During that time, he served in the personnel section of a tank battalion in Korea for 11 months, all the way from the 38th parallel to the Manchurian border. In 1953, he and his wife Lois began farming. They had five children who, when they were old enough, all showed dairy cattle at the farm. All showed dairy cattle at the fair. We started showing when each of us was probably 8 years old, said Larry Mueller. We showed at the Washington County Fair all through our growing up years. Larry Mueller said he liked getting together with friends and neighbors to show animals at the fair. Through 4-H, Mueller said he learned what type and quality of cattle that the industry was looking for. He said his wife, Lee, who is the postmaster at Arlington, helped him clean pens when he was showing animals in 4-H. Lee and Larry had four children who all showed dairy cattle at the fair. One of those children, Nathan, said he appreciates the life skills he learned through 4-H. It helps teach responsibility and about getting organized and getting prepared for something which you need later in life, Mueller said. Today, Larry and his brothers, Lowell and Dennis, work at the family dairy farm at Hooper. Nathan Mueller is an extension educator for cropping systems for Dodge in Washington County. He and his wife Ashley have two sons, Garrison and Case. Garrison showed for the first time on Saturday in the Clover Kids division. During Clover Kids competition, the judge will ask children questions about his animals. What did Garrison like about showing his calf? Talking into the microphone, he said. Looking back, Orlando said he never thought he'd have four generations of family members showing animals at the county fair. He added that his great-grandfather is buried in a church cemetery on the family farm. The next generations of Muellers are looking toward the future. Today, he, Garrison, showed for the first time as a Clover Kid, Ashley said. The next big thing for him is kindergarten. That's the end of the article. It is the end of part two of the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, July 29th, 2015. This is Debbie signing off, saying talk to you again next week.